So in my review of the new Matrix film, I talked about the fact that I was a big fan of the original trilogy, not just the first film, the entire trilogy. And this is different to most people who are mainly focused on the first film and they don't really make much of the sequels. Now, on an exoteric level, which means on a surface level, there's no doubt that the first film is far superior to the second and third films. But on an esoteric level, which means beneath the surface, there's still much enjoyment to be had from viewing the second and third films, and indeed viewing the trilogy as one whole rather than three separate parts. So, I'm going to talk about some of the esoteric symbolism and various themes explored in the Matrix trilogy. I'm not going to cover all of it because I'd be literally here all day. I'm just going to cover a few key things. So, in the first Matrix film, you've got this character Neo, and he is very clearly a messianic figure, a Christ-like figure. In fact, in one of the early scenes in the first Matrix film, when some of Neo's friends come to his apartment, one of them literally refers to Neo as my own personal Jesus Christ. Right? And obviously, as we all know, Neo, NEO, is an anagram of one, as in the one. This messianic Christ-like figure. Now, the film starts out when Neo looks like he's in his early 30s. What age was Jesus Christ when he starts his ministry? He was in his early 30s. So you can see the correlation, you can see the Christian influence. Now, I'm well aware that the themes in Christianity in terms of death and rebirth and messianic figures, these things occurred in religions and mythology long predating Christianity. I'm well aware of that. But for Western audiences, most people are familiar with these concepts in a Christian context. So anyway, you've got this messianic Christ-like figure, Neo, who is baptized by Morpheus. That's literally what happens. He's baptized. Morpheus is the John the Baptist character. And what happens when Neo is awoken from the Matrix? He sits up in this bathtub and pulls this thing out of his mouth and gasps for air. That's like when somebody's being baptized. When their head gets pushed down, then they come up out of the water, and then they're gasping for air again. In Christianity, when you are baptized, they say that you are born again. And in the Matrix, what do you see? You see Neo naked, hairless, in the fetal position, in this amniotic sac, surrounded by amniotic fluid, which he then wakes up from and breaks out of. And when he's rescued by the Nebuchadnezzar, and of course, there's lots of symbolism regarding that. But when he's rescued by Morpheus and his team on the Nebuchadnezzar, Neo's eyes are really sensitive. He finds it hard to open his eyes because the light is hurting them, just like a newborn baby. So Neo has literally been born again into a new reality. The old Matrix version of himself, Tom Anderson, is now dead. So you got Morpheus, the John the Baptist figure. Again, these are archetypes. It's not exactly like for like. Morpheus is John the Baptist and Neo is Jesus, but it's heavily influenced by these archetypes. Oh, and I nearly forgot Cypher, who is the Judas character, the one who sells them out. He is representative of people in society who feel like if you can't beat them, join them. These are people that ultimately have no true conviction. These tend to be very envious and jealous people. People who are afflicted with tremendous insecurity, those are the ones who end up saying, if you can't beat them, join them, who are not really up for any kind of fight. When there's a war on for the soul of humanity, a battle between good and evil, they're going to side with evil because it's the easy thing to do. And most people do that. Then you've got Neo's girlfriend in the first, who becomes his girlfriend, Trinity. And what is the Trinity in Christianity? It's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So when Neo encounters the Trinity, that helps to make him complete, basically, because towards the end of the first Matrix film, Neo dies in a hallway when he's fighting with these agents. He dies, and it's the Trinity that brings him back to life, the death and resurrection. And just like Jesus, Neo is more powerful when he comes back from the dead than he was in life. So very strong very heavy Christian influence in the first Matrix film. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's the most popular of the films, with fans and critics alike. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons. Because again, even though a lot of people in the West today identify themselves as atheists, they are still subconsciously influenced by Christian beliefs, by the whole concept of messianic figures who are going to come and deliver us from evil and all this kind of business. You see it in politics still to this day, where you have these messianic figures. That's the way that the public see them, even if the public identify themselves as atheists. So again, I think the Christian undertones of the first Matrix film and the way it was neatly wrapped up in a bow at the end, where Neo dies and is resurrected, and then he's going to start fighting against the system, and you know the system's days are basically numbered now. All it took is for the Messiah to return, and then evil's basically done for. That's the story of the first Matrix film. But the second and the third films are, in my opinion, more mature films, because they reveal reality and spirituality to be more nuanced than the messianic paradigm, which is comparatively simplistic and to some degree naive. The second and third films challenge the characters within the Matrix, but also the audience, to grow and evolve beyond that. In the first film, the Oracle is seen as a pure being of light who's just there to help Neo and the Resistance fight against the system. Whereas in the second film, we find out that the Oracle is actually part of the system. So there are actors, and I'm using the word actors loosely here, there are actors on the world stage who might appear to be against the system, but are actually part of the system. And they're actually part of a system of control, whereby they allow a certain amount of rebellion. They allow a certain amount of pushback from the people. It's necessary in order to keep the system intact. If you try and suppress the human spirit completely, the system can't work. And that is what is expressed in the second film. That's what the architect explains to Neo, because this one, this anomaly, as the architect describes it in the second Matrix film, is a reoccurring thing. Neo has had several predecessors in several previous versions of the Matrix. There were these exceptional individuals who were able to manipulate the Matrix in accordance with their will and break the rules, basically, of the Matrix, or at least bend the rules of the Matrix. So the architect said it's impossible to eliminate this systemic anomaly, so therefore we have to try and accommodate it. And this is a metaphor for the world that we're living in. You can't completely railroad the human spirit. There's always going to be people who want freedom, people who value personal sovereignty and individual liberty above all else. And if you don't accommodate a certain element of that, the system is not going to work. And so that is a theme that is explored in the second Matrix film. And you understand then that the Oracle is actually part of that. Not that she's necessarily bad, because the Oracle is more reasonable than, let's say, the architect. You know, she just wants peace. And she explains that the only way we're going to achieve peace is by doing it together, basically. So that's an interesting theme that they explore in the second Matrix film, or an interesting idea. Then you've got the emergence of this Agent Smith character, who's also been reborn, because he was seemingly destroyed by Neo at the end of the first film. But he's reborn a new man in the second film, and there's some element of Neo that has been inherited by himself because of the fact that Neo literally dove into him and destroyed him, seemingly destroyed him from the inside out. And Agent Smith is representative of what happens when you have these two forces fighting each other, the oppressive force and the libertarian force. And when they continuously fight each other, they're only going to end up destroying each other. That's the inevitable conclusion. And so Agent Smith was representative of that. This is what happens if you guys don't actually learn to cooperate and don't actually learn to make compromises on both sides. And that's why in the third Matrix film, which I'll come on to, the two sides have to learn to work together again more. And you do see some of that in the new Matrix film. They explore the fact that now some of the machines are actually on the human side and all this kind of thing. Also, as I mentioned in my review of the new Matrix film, in the original Matrix trilogy, you've got the realms of mind, body, and spirit represented by three different colors. Green represents the mind, blue represents the body, and gold represents the spirit. And so in the scenes where they're in the Matrix, the film has a green tint to it. Scenes where they're in the physical world, as in Zion, the film has a blue tint to it. And the scenes where Neo is seeing purely with his spiritual eyes, because his physical eyes have been destroyed by Agent Smith, Neo is able to see the spiritual realm, and it's gold. Okay, so those are the three realms represented by three colors. And it's not until Neo starts following his intuition, and well, I say not until, but even in the first film, Neo was following his intuition. Like when he went to go and save Morpheus, at that point, he didn't believe he was the one, but he still went to go and save him. And they were asking, why are you going to go and do it? It's a suicide mission. And he said, I know it is. I know it seems that way, but I just know. I just know that I can actually go in there and save him. I know I can. And that's what happens in the first Matrix film. Against all logic, he manages to actually do it. So that is hinting at the fact that humanity has something beyond the physical, a spiritual element which is far more powerful than the system would have you believe. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that people in our real world can do the kind of things that Neo in the Matrix could do. But again, it's allegory and it's metaphor. So anyway, in the second Matrix film, at the end of the film, Neo's ability transcends the mind, because the fact that he can fly around and do all this crazy stuff in the Matrix is still just mind. You're still in the realm of mind at that point. But when it's at the end of the film and they're lost in those tunnels, right? Their spaceship breaks down or whatever, and the Sentinels are coming for them. Neo then puts his hand out and he's able to stop the Sentinels in the physical world. So again, that's his spiritual power transcending the mind and now crossing over into the physical world. He can actually affect things in the physical world with his spiritual power. And just as an aside, you've got the Morpheus character, John the Baptist. He is a dogmatic-minded person. And at the end of the second Matrix film, he basically has an ego death where he has to completely reevaluate who he is and what the world actually is. There's a line at the end where I think he says something like, for all these years, I have believed a dream, but that dream is gone for me now. Something like that. Because he believed that once the One returns, as in Neo, the war will be over. But that didn't happen, of course. You know, in the second film and all that kind of stuff. He believed that the Sentinel army would never actually reach the gates of Zion. Again, he was wrong about that. So this is a dogmatic-minded person having an ego death. I think it was it Joseph Campbell who first referred to it as an ego death, but also Carl Jung, I think he called it a psychic death, which is the same kind of concept. So anyway, finally, in the third Matrix film, you've got this apocalyptic scenario, doomsday, where everybody, all the different characters, have to face up to their greatest fears. And one of the interesting things, I've already talked about Morpheus being a dogmatic person. His rival, because Morpheus was with, I forget her name, but Jada Pinkett's character. Morpheus used to go out with her, but then the Oracle tells him something and they break up. And then Jada Pinkett ends up being with Commander Locke, who is Morpheus's superior. And Commander Locke is also a dogmatic character. Commander Locke is like a very left brain character who completely dismisses any notion of the world of spirit. He's very, very much locked into the left brain and the physical dimension. He doesn't even make much of the Matrix itself. In terms of what Neo can do in the Matrix, he dismisses all that. He's completely rooted in the blue world of Zion. That's it. The green Matrix, he doesn't make much of. And the gold world of spirit, he doesn't even believe exists. So in the second and third films, the Council, who are like the government of Zion, they allow several ships to be sent out to go and find Neo, Trinity, and all these other people, because they believe that Neo will actually save Zion. Whereas Commander Locke doesn't believe in all that. He doesn't believe in prophecies or oracles or miracles or spirituality or anything like that. And of course, what it shows you in that third film is that Commander Locke was completely wrong. Because if they hadn't sent Neo off, you know, if they hadn't allowed him to have a ship and allowed him to go to the Machine City, and at that point he's physically blind, and it's just him and Trinity, and nobody's ever got close to the Machine City, but Neo knows. His intuition tells him he knows he can go there and he must go there. And that's what he does. And he's able to see all the machines as spiritual entities when he's physically blind. And of course, he's able to stop them. And when he gets to the Machine City, of course, he makes a deal. They put him into the Matrix. He destroys Agent Smith ultimately. And they don't live happily ever after. At the end of the film, there's basically a truce. And the Oracle says to the Architect, what happens to those who want out? You know, the rest of the people in the Matrix who want out. And the Architect says, obviously, they'll be freed. And she says, do I have your word? And he's like, what do you think I am, human? Which is a, you know, little joke about human nature. He also says to her, how long do you think this so-called peace can last? And the Oracle says, as long as it can. And so the theme in the third Matrix film is that there isn't really an apocalypse, which is a war to end all wars. No, that whole concept of an apocalypse is just a cyclical thing where we're going round and round and round through different epochs where it all builds up to a head. Then we have what we think of as an apocalypse, but then we just start again, going round and round in circles in a loop. You see, it's like the pressure builds up in this battle between these opposing forces. And once the pressure reaches a certain point, you know, boiling point or bursting point, it all bursts. And then we start again from, not necessarily from scratch, but we start again. We start the same process again over and over. Okay, and of course, this reminds you of Indian spiritual traditions in Hinduism and Buddhism and stuff like that, where they have the yugas, these cycles that we go through. There's a lot of influence of that, particularly in the second and third Matrix films, far more so than the Christian influence, which we see more in the first film. But anyway, going back to what I was saying, I know I'm jumping around all over the place here. You've got these two dogmatic characters in Morpheus and Locke. Morpheus is dogmatic about prophecy. He's dogmatic about his spiritual beliefs. And Locke is dogmatic about the physical world and his complete dismissal of any notion of spirituality. And the theme which runs strongly through part of the third movie, but mostly the third movie, is again that spirituality is where the ultimate power lies. It's not in the world of the physical, it's not in the world of the mind, but it's in spirituality, which transcends the mind and transcends the physical world. And by the way, if you watch the Animatrix, it will explain or briefly touch on the fact that the machines in the Matrix films do actually have a spirit, because we don't tend to think of machines as having spirit. Whereas in the Animatrix, it explains that they were imbued with the pure spirit of mankind. So the machines in the Matrix are actually sentient. That's explored actually in, with the Smith character, you see that he's becoming sentient. You also see it with one of the programs when Neo is trapped in this subway that he can't leave from. And there's this Indian guy who comes along, who's a program, and he starts talking about the concept of love. And Neo says, machines can't feel love. But again, if you watch the Animatrix, it explains that actually these machines have at least some element of humanity in them. Some of that divine spark is in them. They're not completely like humans, of course, but they're closer to humans than we tend to think of, you know, machines in most cases. Another thing that they show in the Matrix is that most people can't be woken up. Again, this is a metaphor for our human society. Most people can't be woken up to the way the world really works. And that's why in the Matrix, you see the majority of people are just living their lives and they're totally oblivious to the fact that there's this war going on. They're happy to remain in their dream world. And as Morpheus explains in the first movie, they are so inert, they're so hopelessly reliant on the system that they will fight to defend the system which enslaves them. This is an example of groupthink, the hive mind, what Carl Jung called the collective unconscious. The ruling powers construct a fake reality for the hive mind. They feed it into the hive mind to blind the masses from the truth. And this has always been the case throughout human history, right up until the present day. In the Matrix, the people who have broken away from the hive mind are only a small minority who are then demonized, marginalized, and hunted down by agents of the system. This is indicative of how dangerous the hive mind actually is, because it subverts the critical thinking processes of the individual. This is actually the default position of most human beings in society. Highly educated people are like this. The majority of them are like this. In any society, at any point in human history, the majority are always slaves to the hive mind. There's only ever a small minority who will go against the prevailing narrative of the time. And those people, if they are academics, scientists, etc., they will be vilified by the masses and by the academics who the ruling oligarchy use as sock puppets to parrot their propaganda and push their agenda. One thing I forgot to mention is the red pill and blue pill in the Matrix. The blue pill is what you take to remain in the Matrix and stay asleep. The red pill is what you take when you want to wake up to the reality of the world. Now, there are many interpretations of why these particular colors are significant, and I'm not claiming to have the definitive interpretation. I'm just going to offer you one of the interpretations. At the end of the day, you would have to ask the makers of the Matrix, you know, you'd have to have an esoteric conversation and ask them why they specifically use the colors of red and blue with regards to these pills, where that came from, why it was those particular colors rather than, let's say, green and yellow, for example. But anyway, one interpretation is that blue is the color of the first 3 degrees, I believe, in Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And so in the first 3 degrees, Masons at that level don't really know much in terms of the esoteric knowledge. But once you advance and progress beyond the first 3 degrees, you're out of the blue degrees into what some people would class as what? Red degrees, the Red Lodge. And then you're going to learn far more about the esoteric knowledge. So blue perhaps representing the ignorance, and then red representing the enlightenment. I don't know. It's just one interpretation of many. But that's certainly what it represents in the Matrix films, right? Blue is ignorance and red is enlightenment. But of course, with red comes pain, comes challenge. If you want to wake up to the realities of this world, you're going to be challenged mentally, spiritually, and physically. The hard thing to do is to wake up. The easy thing to do is to stay asleep and believe the narrative that you're told through the various institutions of orthodoxy. That's the easy thing to do. Ignorance is bliss. Ignorance really is bliss. And that's actually what the Cypher character says in the first Matrix film when he's eating that steak and he's meeting up with Agent Smith. He says, ignorance is bliss, because he's not built for the fight. He is somebody who is spiritually weak. And because he's spiritually weak, he doesn't really have a sense, a strong sense of morality, of right and wrong. All he cares about is himself. He doesn't care about any greater battle or greater struggle. He's just interested in the very shallow titillation that you get from being a famous person, eating at nice restaurants, having nice women and all that kind of stuff. He isn't searching for any deeper fulfillment, you know, on a spiritual level, or even just a deeper mental and intellectual level. He's not searching for any of that. He doesn't care about any of that, which is why he sells his friends out. And of course, people like that in the real world will always be tools of evil because they are morally incompetent. And the truth is, and it's a sad truth, the majority of people in our world that we live in here are like that. They're more like the Cyphers of the world rather than the Morpheuses, the Trinities, and the Neos. Most people are like that. And again, that's shown in the Matrix. Most people stay asleep. They can't be woken up. They'll fight to defend the system and so on. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this video about the Matrix trilogy. Again, on an exoteric level, just purely in terms of visual spectacle, direction, dialogue, cinematography, etc., the first film is the best. But the second and third films are still very, very rich in terms of esoteric meaning. They're not as exoterically impressive, but on an esoteric level, they're still very enjoyable. And there are other characters I haven't touched on, of course. Again, we'd be here all day if I was to go through every single character in the Matrix, like, for example, the Merovingian, the Frenchman, who sits down and starts talking about causality, you know, cause and effect. And he says that choice is an illusion created by people who have power to control people who don't. You know, they give them the illusion of choice. And of course, there's a lot of truth in that. You look at the political system, that's a perfect example of the illusion of choice, certainly in a country like Britain. In America, to some degree, but less so. But in Britain, I mean, there's no choice politically at all. Now, anyway, I'll leave it there. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Catch you on the next one. I'm out.